Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This week on the Mike Wise Show, we welcome yet another Hall of Famer. He will be our 15th and is one of the most unique. He never dunked in a game, but some of his most memorable work has been above the rim. Are you intrigued? I am. He's standing by, but first, Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Thank you, Darlene. This is a very special episode that features a full video version on the Pure Hoops Media YouTube channel. We haven't done that since, Jeannie Buss joined us a while back. Andrew D. Bernstein, Andy to his friends and me, is the senior NBA photographer and the recipient of the Kurt Gowdy Media Award for print from the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. If you listen to this show, you have experienced classic NBA moments as seen through his lens. He's also the host of a podcast called Legends of Sport, where his guest list is remarkable. Welcome, Andy. Thank you for sharing some time with us today.
Hey, Mike, it's so great to see you, man. I can't even remember the last time we actually saw each other in person. It was great to reconnect.
Well, I can tell you exactly when it was because you're memorable. And I also basically begged you to take a couple of shots of me and Shaquille O'Neal at his Hall of Fame induction 5 years ago at the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. And so I have these great pictures of me and Shaq in his like monstrous orange jacket. Kids can't believe that there's any human that big in their life.
Was that so, 5 years ago, Mike? Holy crap.
I know, it's crazy, right? I believe it was the September of 2016, which is just great. It is. It's insane. Yeah. And it was a great class. It was, it was Shaquille O'Neal, the big names, Yao Ming and Allen Iverson.
Yeah, that was a crazy class, yeah.
I have a picture, actually, that I took myself of Bill Walton and Yao Ming. Bill Walton looks like me next to Shaq. It was incredible. It's like one of the great, whatever.
That was a great, remember that moment where Shaq put Yao's jacket on him?
Oh, that's right.
That was so great.
Yeah, that was neat.
And hard to believe it's now 5 years next month that Kobe retired. Can you believe
it? Is it? Wow. April 13th. That's 5 years that he retired.
Yeah.
I feel like I watched that 60-point game yesterday.
Tell me about it. I know. It's just mind-blowing. Everything that's happened, it's just incredible. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're going to discuss your Hall of Fame career as a photographer, but I want to start with the podcast. You've been a high-profile member of the basketball community for nearly four decades, but not as a host. What made you decide to jump into the podcast space? And don't tell me I saw that you did it, so I figured anybody could, because that's true.
I actually was going to say that, but no. I needed something to fall back on after 40 years. I don't know, Mike. No, what happened was about 7-8 years ago, a couple of good friends of mine and I created this platform called Legends of Sport. We both, all three of us had, pretty busy careers. We didn't really know what was going to become of it, quite frankly. And I started to do a show concurrently on the Laker TV network called Through the Lens, where I would sit with Jeannie Buss or Phil Jackson or James Worthy, a Laker personality, and to talk about their career through my photos. It's kind of like sports reporters, but with actual visuals, right. So, and I took to that. I really enjoyed it. I had a great producer who taught me how to be relaxed and not worry about the cameras and all that and just have a conversation. And I really found, Mike, that I enjoyed, like you you've been doing this for so long. I just enjoyed talking to people and getting their stories and where they started. I know so many people, but I don't really know like where it all started for them. And everybody's got a story, right?
Sure. So yeah, everybody, yeah, go ahead.
So fast forward, right? I'm at a Laker game, and the great Norm Pattis, good friend of mine, who you know, Norm sits courtside. He's the guy who's always doing this with the program, right? He sits right next to the Laker bench. I've known Norm for 30 years. He owns Podcast One at the time, the platform. And he calls me over. He goes, Andy, been watching that Laker show you're doing. I got to get that on my podcast network. And I said, well, Norm, I love you. Thank you. It's flattering, but you know, it's a visual show. Like we show in photos. And he says, we'll figure it out. Come have lunch. So next day, go have lunch. 2.5 hours later, we hammer out this idea for a podcast, and it debuts on his podcast network. And we were there for 2 years. And now in this third season, we're partnered with the LA Times and distributed by them, and as well as all the other big networks. But you know, I just did my 125th podcast today, and it was, you know,
How many?
125.
But Bruce, I think he's got me by about 20 shows at least. is that accurate?
I think this is show number 108 for you, Mike.
Yeah, so, see,
Andy's plus 17.
See, now I feel really stupid because he's done more than me. He's more experienced at this than him. What am I even doing asking him the questions?
No, come on, Mike. But I ended up doing a show every week when I was in the bubble last summer, which was really crazy. Doing it from a crazy hotel room on the Disney property. That was nuts. But it was fun, and we cranked out some great stuff on the restart of the NBA and the WNBA and the respective bubbles. Got a lot of traction, and the Times was behind it. And now we're releasing every other week, which is great. Gives us more time to prepare. And it's fun. I just love doing it. It's super fun.
Well, I think what you said in the beginning is sort of, what's the story? What's your real story? And especially through your photos. One of my favorite things they used to do with the New York Times Magazine. And I have like a kind of an Ali collection behind me. Yeah. And the one up there, there's one where Ali's walking with his hands in his pockets, and he's walking through Harlem, and it's a photo. I can't remember who took it, but my friend Catherine St. Jean, she was in charge of the section. And the whole idea was taking a historic photo from, you know, back then of a person that might be prominent. And you ask them right then, they go, what were you thinking? And they Ali's answer was tremendous, but all of them, you know, like every one was memorable because some of them you just came out of the blue, some of it came, you know, but it was like, what were you thinking in that moment? And you know, and it forces people, especially still photos, it forces them to go back and really, really, really think about it, like original deliberate thought. It's not just off the cuff of their head. And video, it's in a weird way, I love video, and it's great, but there's another thing about still photos. It sort of gives you that theater of the mind. Like you're almost, there's a little bit of an imagination that goes with it.
Yeah.
And so,
it's so interesting you bringing that up, because that's the exact experience I had with Kobe when we started doing our book, The Mamba Mentality, together. You know, he would ask for very specific moments, right? And he would actually remember some photos that I shot specifically for each section of the book. But then I'd give him, like, say, a photo of the young Kobe against the veteran Jordan, you know, teacher-student photo, which I thought, you know, it's a nice picture. It's been reproduced a gazillion times. And he could care less about the, like, photographic quality of the picture. He would break it down by muscle tone and where he's leaning. Wow. And in fact, that photo of he and Jordan leads off that section, and his caption for that photo is, "Everything I'm doing in this picture is wrong." I mean, who does that? Their own book, you know?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So that's what he was thinking in the moment, just like you were saying. Yeah.
Some people associate you with the NBA as a whole. I just, because you're in LA and because the Lakers were so successful during the time when I covered the NBA between, 95 and 2000, I feel like 20 years, like the Shaq Kobe years, all the things that went on with it. I feel like, and I don't know this for sure, but I feel like of all the players you developed relationships with that you covered and took pictures of, Kobe might have been Kobe might have been as close to someone that you ever got.
Yeah, because, well, almost solely because he was in front of my camera the most in 20 years. Now, you know, I covered all of Magic's career, all of James Worthy's career.
Correct.
Both of them were shorter. Obviously, Magic's significantly shorter. But once Kobe came in, and I had done a lot with Shaq too, but Shaq at that time, you know, was playing Orlando at the first 4 or 5 years, right? So once Kobe came in, you know, I was embedded with him basically for those 20 years of his career. And then, you know, Phil and I did our book together in 2009-10. And I was literally living with the team that entire season. And Kobe and I had just really established a great relationship, you know, very professional, but also on the personal side as well. There was a tremendous amount of trust. And I don't know, an innate ability to know when to get in and when to get out on these behind the scenes moments. I think I learned that from Pat Riley, who was very clear as when he wanted me out. And then Phil and I had a kind of this like sort of tap dance kind of relationship where I always knew what Phil was thinking and when he didn't want me in the room and when he didn't care if I was in the room. And Kobe was the same way, although Kobe was a lot more welcoming and forgiving. But I did understand what it meant to be discreet and what it meant to give him his time and, you know, not have a camera in his face, basically. So I think he respected that and he respected what I did, you know, just like with you as a journalist and all the journalists that covered him. I know for a fact how Kobe respected what we do for a living, and our job is to cover him, right? And might not particularly like what you write, right? Sometimes. But, you know, Howard Beck tells this great story about how he and Kobe had this back and forth.
Right.
But then, you know, Howard said to Kobe's credit, you know what? I know you got to do what you got to do as long as you're honest. Right. So that's what it's about.
Yeah. I always found that, especially if I was preparing to write something critical about someone, if I was either on the beat or covering the NBA and I could get access to them, I would tell them, I would say, look, I'm writing this. You might not like it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes at least they didn't feel like I was betraying them in a weird way. Like I wasn't sort of the guy that piled up to them in the locker room and then would write something. Like I would just say, like, if their game had something to do with hurting the team. But the only time I really would sort of really try and make sure I was doing the right thing was if it was a personal thing, like there was a locker room issue and that was going in there. And players to this day shoot anybody for that matter, politicians, anybody. I tell classes this all the time, like just, if you can get to the person or their PR person, just tell them what you're working on before you run it. And they, you know, and that way they don't feel like they're blindsided. And most of the time, especially when they read things about them that are critical and they realize that it's true, they respect you more. Yeah. You know, they sort of like all of a sudden you're welcomed into this club of, oh, wow, not only could he find shit out about me, but he would write it.
Yeah, right.
And so at any rate, it's, I don't know. I think the give and take is great. It's the biggest, it's a weird trade-off because so many people now trade off sort of buddy issues for access. Mm-hmm. And you were never put in that position because you were essentially working for the NBA.
Yeah, that's
that was your job.
Yeah, and that's a big difference between what you would have to do and what I would have to do, because you know, I am not in the position to show or portray any negativity. Not that you were looking to do, you know, to write about something negative or find something negative to write about, but that was part of your job, right? You know, my job isn't about that. My job is really honestly to make them look as good as possible, whether it's on the court, off the court, or just show an honest representation of what goes on, especially behind the scenes, but never anything compromising or questionable or anything like that. You know, during the whole Shaq and Kobe sort of give and take era, which everyone continues to make a big deal about, you know, all I saw, quite honestly, was two guys driven maybe by, you know, different engines, but needed each other and both wanted to win, you know, and they respected each other when they got, you know, to the arena and when they were on the court together, they were lethal, right?
Yes.
So that's my job. Yeah. That's my job.
Yeah. There was a good drama, and it was obviously two young stars who were both alpha males in many ways. But like they said later on, you know, shoot, if we had gotten over our own personal stuff, we would have won 5 or 6 championships together. It was ridiculous. I was in shock when he died, but even the anniversary, I remember thinking, this didn't happen. If I woke up tomorrow and somebody told me, you know, that whole Kobe helicopter crash, that didn't really happen. It was just some bad dream. I would believe that because it just seems to this moment we're speaking right now, it blows me away. It's like, if you, not that helicopter crashes with athletes and famous people don't happen, but not that any other person was supposed to go instead of Kobe, but the fact that it's one of the top 5-7 players of all time. It's this guy that's basically embarking on a post NBA career that is going to mean something. It's already meant something. And here he is, you know, finally getting the, whatever it is, the time to spend with his kids and his family that he never had as a retired guy or as an active player. And I was floored. I can't imagine what it was like when you heard and where you were.
Well, I was literally in this room when I heard about it. It was a Sunday morning. I had just taken my daughter to her Hebrew school class, which I do every Sunday before the pandemic. And my wife gets that Sunday morning to herself at home. And my time is I come in the office, just clean up stuff, maybe just, you know, do a little housekeeping, whatever, in the couple hours that she's in school, and I go pick her up. And I don't really pay attention to my phone actually during that time. I have some loud Springsteen music on, as I always do. And my phone is just like buzzing off the table at like around, I don't know, 10:15, 10:20. And finally I look at it and friends are texting me, is it true about Kobe? Is it true about Kobe? And I'm like, I don't know what that means, right? And just as I'm reading that, Joe Amati, who you might know from NBA Photos, my boss at NBA Photos, calls me and he says, you have a TV there? I said, yeah. He says, turn it on. And right there, you know, CNN was starting to report it, you know, based on the TMZ reporting. And he and I just were speechless. I mean, I just could not believe what I was seeing. And fast forward a year later, I feel exactly the same way, exactly like you do. I cannot believe, I'm looking beyond my screen here. The entire wall is filled with pictures of him because I can't not look at him every day. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And on top of that, the building owner in the complex I'm in and I have commissioned a muralist to do a mural from one of my photos outside, that's literally going to be outside my window so I could see him every moment of every day.
That's awesome.
And the public will enjoy it too. So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I just remember when it happened, going into people we call and whatever it was, PBS or whoever, NewsHour, I would go on and I would do something. And then I was working at the CBS DC and CBS affiliate in Washington, and I would do something for them. And I would go on the late news and talk about, you know, my peripheral relationship with him more than a real personal one. But at any rate, it was, and then it took me about 3 days when I sort of like was stopped doing the interviews and I wasn't the wanted media guy anymore. And my son and I were watching it and he just goes, he was only 40. Was he 38? He goes, he wasn't 40. He goes, he's not going to get to see his kids anymore. I lost it. I lost it. Cause it's like sort of all of a sudden it's like, it didn't matter that Kobe Bryant was one of the most famous basketball players on the planet. Didn't matter whether he touched all these lives. It mattered. He was a dad and he's gone and his kids weren't going to see him. It's like that hit home harder than anything.
Yeah. And his child went with him. And then, you know,
Gianna, did you know her very well?
Yeah, of course. Since she was a newborn.
Oh
yeah. And, you know, all those moments of him bringing Natalia and Gigi to the games as they were little. You remember during the finals and he'd bring them up on the podium.
Oh, it was great.
And then I'm thinking of Vanessa, like how is this woman how is she going to go on? I mean, and the strength that she showed at the memorial, my wife was watching it at home and thank God, honestly, Mike, that the family had asked me to photograph the memorial. I was the only photographer on the floor because I couldn't. I mean, I was literally shooting and crying, like the viewfinders filling up with tears. It was unbelievable. But the strength that she showed and continues to show is so amazing to me, and is such a statement of the kind of person that she is.
Man, I was thinking the start of your career with the NBA also coincided with the start of Michael Jordan's NBA career. And your shot of Michael and his late father with the O'Brien Trophy after the 1991 championship has to be one of the most memorable photos. It took place in a crowded locker room, yet it appeared as if Michael and his father were all alone with that trophy. What do you remember about that moment?
Oh, Mike, I remember like it was yesterday, quite honestly. Like you said, the Bulls won the championship at the Forum. Now, you remember the old Forum visitors locker room, right?
Yes.
Essentially,
it was a cracker box.
Yeah, it was like a glorified men's room, basically.
Right.
And it was so small. And they used to let everybody in there right away. There was no, like, you know, vetting of people or credentials. You know, as soon as the championship was won, people flooded into the locker room. The team came in, champagne's flying all over the place. And at the same time, some genius said, oh, well, let's do the live trophy presentation from the locker room. That's what they were doing in those days. So the network, I think it was CBS, constructed like a makeshift stage in the corner. They got cameras jammed in there, producers, everybody. And they're presenting the trophy to the Bulls, to the team. And, you know, Michael's up there. The whole team is up there. All hell is breaking loose. And the only vantage point I can get is the folding table in the middle of the locker room, which all the teams have. You've seen it a million times. The tickets and the gum and all the stuff.
The nutritional spread.
Exactly. I jump up on this table. Thank God I was pretty light at the time. So I could see above everybody and get that photo. And then they go to commercial and they want to come back and interview Michael one-on-one, and nobody can find Michael. They're like, and people are screaming and the champagne flies, chaos, right?
Sure.
And I'm up on this table and I don't know, there's some sixth sense or some voice said, look to your left. And I go like this, and I mean, literally 6 feet away from me, there he is in the locker with his dad holding the trophy, crying his eyeballs out. Nobody had actually seen him yet at that moment. And then I turned, clicked two frames, and he got bombarded, and then they yanked him to do the interview.
But those two frames are etched in history.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know what's crazy is in The Last Dance, they showed that moment on video, and then they stop the frame, and you can actually see me in the ball of the trophy because it's so reflective. You can see me and my camera, my flash in the photo, in like that moment. That was nuts. I was blown away by that.
You should pause that and get a photo of that. I think that should be your credential from now on.
Yeah, right.
That would be.
Yeah, but if I'm remembered for one photo in my career, I would love it to be that one, because not only was it a significant moment at the time, you know, Michael's winning his first championship. None of us knew how many were going to be in front of him, but he's there with his dad, which of course was very poignant. And when his dad passed away, about 6 months later, I got a call from Michael's office saying that Michael had requested a print for his office of that photo, and would I mind sending it to him? And of course. So the fact that he has that hanging somewhere, you know, means a lot to me.
It's your photo.
Yeah.
The 92 Dream Team, which Michael was a part of, obviously the most famous international basketball team of all time. And I think it will always be that, because it was the first team of professional players that weren't paid Eastern Europeans at the time. And I don't know. I just think that, like, when you're with those guys and you're hanging out with all the people from NBA TV that are filming that for posterity's sake, are you realizing it's history at the time? Or are you thinking, hey, it's just the guys I've been filming and they're all together this time? Or do you, is there a self-awareness button in your head going, wow, I'm part of the shit, man. This is it.
Yeah, it hit me pretty early, Mike. I got to tell you, you know, I got assigned to be with the team from the beginning in San Diego, the very first meeting of the team. 7 weeks later, you know, through San Diego, Portland, Monaco, Barcelona. 7 weeks later, they're getting the gold medal, you know, and I was there every day. And I did have to pinch myself, honestly.
How much did you make at that point? Just roughly.
Money-wise?
Yeah, roughly. What did you make about then? I mean, it's a long time.
I don't even remember, honestly. Yeah. I don't remember. I was, that was 92. I wasn't an employee of the NBA yet. It was a window of time when I was. So I was a freelancer. I don't know.
Making freelance money. Whatever you made, you need to send it back to the Hall of Fame. Like, nobody should be able to do that for and get paid for it.
Yeah, right.
You should have been doing it. That was God's work, and you should have been doing
it. It was you're 100% right. I always say it's the best assignment I ever had. And if I could have retired after that, man, it would have been a good career. But I was kind of my career was just sort of getting off the ground at that point. But
they obviously knew you as the photographer on the beat with them. Was everybody friendly, nice, or were they all right, take it easy here? This is our off season.
It was so great. In fact, I brought my dad, who is a huge sports fan, and probably I got into sports photography was because of my bonding over sports with my dad. I brought him to Monaco and to Barcelona. So he became a fixture of the team to the point where the guys started referring to him as Zelig. Because remember Zelig?
Right.
Like every time I took a picture, this is true. Almost every time I took a picture, this my dad is like in the background somewhere.
He's where's Waldo?
Yes, I think Terry Lyons or Brian or somebody
Zelig.
Zelig again, you know.
Yeah.
And they were incredibly nice. In fact, my dad met Michael's dad during that whole experience. So we kind of bonded over that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I still remember like just little bits and pieces. But that bird game in Portland where it was sort of turned back the clock and he started making like even after his back surgery, he was like hitting these jumpers out of his ear and he was doing everything he could possibly. And it was like, wow, he still had it. And he had a decent Olympics, but he wasn't one of those star players because of his body, but it was still so much fun to watch them play together.
Oh, it's crazy. And then, you know, it's legendary. I'm sure you've talked about it, you know, many times on your podcast, but the practices were just off the chart. I mean, off the chart, dude. They, you know, I wasn't at the practice that everyone talks about, but I was at enough of them. And the ones in San Diego were pretty intense as well. You know, they lost that first scrimmage. The Dream Team lost the first scrimmage to that group of college guys.
And the Leitner. I think Allen Houston was on that team.
Chris Webber. And so when that happened, it was like, all right, this is not going to be a cakewalk. Okay. This is not vacation.
Yeah.
Michael and Magic were like, okay, we're going to go to work. And they worked. Yeah. I mean, they had fun. They partied. They had a great time. You know, we were in Monaco for 2 weeks. Let's not forget. But they knew when to bring it. And, the competition wasn't quite up to the task. But even of watching the other teams ask for selfies, like during a game.
Whenever you know it's over when you're trying to get autographs from the guys you're playing. I thought, everybody remembers Barkley elbowing the Angolan player.
Right.
And it became this sort of like the ugly American photo. But what I remember was one of your famous photos was Charles with the little rubber ducky. How did that shot come about?
Well, that was when he got traded to Phoenix, and Sports Illustrated called me and they said, we want you to get a photo of Charles in Phoenix. It was a big story, right, at the time. And it needs to say Phoenix, like that Charles is now like in the desert, you know, and I'm thinking, I'll take him out to some cactus and, you know, get a sunset or rocks or something. He didn't want any part of that. Charles was like, nope. You got to come to practice. And whenever you can get to practice, that's going to be it. So I'm like sweating bullets because I don't know what the hell to get. And I go to practice and our good friend Julie Fi has given me great access.
Julie Fi, by the way, has been on two podcasts in this week. Remember Grant Napier, the play-by-play guy for Yeah, he had me on his podcast mm-hmm. recently, and Julie Fye came up repeatedly. What a godsend she is.
Yeah, she's amazing. I love her to death, and what a great person and quality professional she is. And I think she's the longest tenured PR person in the league now, right?
Yeah, and you know what? I need to have her. I need to have her on.
Yeah, she's great.
She'd be great because she wouldn't give you every piece of dirt. In fact, she wouldn't give you any. But just the particles next to that dirt was better than half the stuff that most people would give us on these podcasts.
That's true. But but on that story, I don't know. She gave me full access. I'm walking through the locker room and the training room. They have that hot tub, and there's Charles in the hot tub. There's a rubber ducky like on the other side, which seems very weird to me that a professional sports team would have a rubber ducky. And I said to him, can I get you with the rubber ducky? He goes, yeah. So he brings it over, and that's the picture. It means nothing about Phoenix.
It was one of the great pose shots of all time. Can I get you with that rubber ducky? That's got to be one of the great lines in your career.
And he's got that Charles like look on his face, the big grin, you know. Anyway. It didn't fulfill the assignment in any way, shape, or form, but at least it made for a fun picture to put in the magazine.
When I started becoming aware of you, I didn't actually, I was one of those late bloomers. Well, no, let's just call it, nobody would give me a job till I was like 30. And I had this job at the Sacramento Union, but I didn't get a job until the New York Times hired me. And it was like 1994, but like where I knew about Andy Bernstein before even I knew you was sort of, there was this magic and bird shot, uh-huh. One that's, it's that photo of them on either side of the O'Brien Trophy breaking out in laughter. And, I look back at that and because Magic and Bird were sort of the last guys that came down off my sort of bedroom walls is sort of like, okay, I'm not a fan anymore. Mm-hmm. I got to give up these guys. I got to cover this sport and I got to cover these people, but it was hard to give them up. This is too much information. I'd have dreams where they would pick me up in like a Jeep Wrangler and I would be on their team. And I would wake up and I was just disappointed about my life when Magic and Bird weren't picking me up in a Jeep Wrangler. And so bottom line is like anytime I got with them after I started covering it as a regular, I tried to play it off like I'm the New York Times guy. And I called, went up to Bird's Hall of Fame induction, and it was so cool. But the other part of me was like, holy Toledo, this is so cool. I'm covering them. You had relationship with those guys. Talk about that photo. What was the story behind that one?
Oh, Mike, that was one of the most nerve-wracking situations of my career. So
when was that?
Well, so this was okay. Let's put it in perspective. 86.
Yeah.
Celtics win the championship, right? They beat Houston.
Beat the Rockets in six.
So in 87, they were projected to meet each other, right? So Sport Magazine projects Lakers Celtics finals in 87, but the magazine comes out before the finals, and the only time to get Magic and Bird together would be in February. The finals don't start till June. In February, when the Celtics came through LA to play the Lakers, the one of two times they played each other, right? So picture this, all right? Picture this happening today. It's a 12:30 game day on a Sunday. I have to go to, I'm pretty sure it was Josh Rosenfeld at the time and Jeff Twiss. And I have to make the request. Sport Magazine, for their cover, wants to have Magic and Bird pose together. And the only time we have to do it is before a 12:30 national game on Sunday. Oh. And they both were like, are you crazy? I said, well, it's got to get done. And they asked the guys. The guys said, okay, you got
from this is how great PR was back then, by the way.
You have from
Josh Rosenfeld, the Lakers PR director, Jeff Twiss, the Celtics PR director, have such a relationship that they could call in a favor with the two greatest players in not just their franchise's history, but two of the greatest players in the history of the game. And they basically said, I know you guys are rivals, but you're starting to respect each other. You already did the conference. Can you do this for us on a game day in the middle of the season? And I'm not saying that PR directors are bad anymore, but they're just faced with so much more because of these guys are so walled around them with people that represent them and people portend to represent them. And so what you get into is sort of a lot of PR directors, by their own admission, become more protectors than facilitators. Yeah, and these guys were like, we know that these guys need to be on this cover of this magazine. We know Andy Bernstein needs to get a shot. How right. awesome is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And so this, I would,
you know, like I can look back on it now as to for the access and everything we get right now. And I can go, that's awesome.
I'm told I have between 1150 and 1152 to get this picture. And if you remember the configuration of the forum locker rooms, the visitors locker room, there was a little like sort of hallway. And then across from it was a Laker girls locker room and then a spare locker room. So I had my stuff set up in there, very easy, simple portrait setup. They were going to both, each PR guy was going to bring those guys in. Right. And I had to be ready. So my idea was like two fighters, you know, the old posters of the two boxers looking at each other.
Ollie Frazier.
Staring each other down with the trophy on a pedestal, like a Greek pedestal, like in between them. Right. And so I get them in there. I say, guys, you know, I got very little time. This is what I want to do. Need you guys looking straight at each other, like the meanest expression you can have, ready to go. And they're like, yeah. I go 3, 2, 1. And just as I'm about to click the trigger, they just crack up. That magic looks at me, goes, man, we can't do this.
That's great. Like,
whatever you can give me, fellas, you know, and I took four.
The organic idea worked better with the magic hat, whatever they came to mind.
Right. But that's the story behind that photo. Everybody thinks they were telling each other a joke or something. No, it was me directing them and then just not doing it.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. There
was another memorable shot. I think it was Julius Erving and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the trophy. But unlike the Bird Magic shot, they're looking at each other like two fierce warriors, like you wanted to be ready to go at each other. Do you remember what the vibe was between them at that moment? Because here's the doctor, very proud guy. And Kareem, as you know, who is as articulate and good a man he is, it doesn't cut up the room like some other people. I'm wondering what that moment was like.
Well, that was the preview for the 83 finals. Same kind of scenario.
Yeah. Where
Philadelphia came in, in January or something. And whoever I was shooting it for, I think it possibly was for the NBA, because I remember that it was reproduced on the old NBA Today tabloid publication that was the only publication the NBA had at the time. Mm. And my idea was to have them sort of a little bit kind of wrestling with the trophy, but tremendous respect between those guys. I remember when they both came in, they chatted, there was total respect there. Mm. And they took direction perfectly. And, you know, I got him in, got him out, you know, but the same scenario as a game night. Never in a gazillion years would that ever happen again. But I'm glad that I had those opportunities.
That was the year that the Sixers. Yeah. The Lakers, that was your, they were due forever, and they finally did it that year.
We were trying to kind of reproduce that photo again with LeBron when he was at Cleveland and Curry, one of those 4 years that they played each other in the finals. And I suggested it, and they basically laughed me out of the room. It's just like, are you nuts?
You couldn't get them both together like that, or that it would just be too hard?
No, it would just never happen. This is
right.
Impossible.
Okay. You did do a book with Phil Jackson, and it chronicled the Lakers' 2010 championship season, which before this current one was their last. I still look at the back-to-back wins in 2009, 2010. And I covered the whole 2009 series. I look back at that and I thought it was such so great for Kobe because, you know, irrespective of how great Shaq was, he finally did it without Shaq. And Pau Gasol's going to be a Hall of Famer in his own right, especially because of his international career as well. Mm-hmm. But he was not one of the top 10 centers of all time. And he was a great passing center, and he could do a lot of things. Kobe, I think, recognizes him as his favorite teammate. But he didn't have, there was a Trevor Ariza, and all those years sort of were after Smush Parker, and which Phil, of course, realized the triangle didn't work as well with. But the bottom line is, like, he rose to another level there. And Phil and him put a lot of bygones behind them because Phil was openly critical of them and Kobe as well. What do you remember about that that project and anything that comes to mind about Phil in that moment?
Well, I think you had to back up to 2008 when the Lakers lost to the Celtics in the finals. And Kobe was devastated. I mean, he talked very openly about it and that he literally would not retire until he avenged that loss, right? So they get to the promised land again in 2009 against Orlando. And I think, honestly, I think he was disappointed that they didn't get to play the Celtics in 2009.
That's right.
But there was a lot riding on it. Like you said, Mike, you know, Kobe and Phil had a strained relationship at that point and they had mended the fence. But there was some lingering stuff in terms of how much Kobe had to take on as the leader of this team, which, like you said, didn't have maybe the premier top level, you know, championship talent around him that he was used to when he, you know, was playing with Shaq. But he, you know, he took Pau Gasol's game to a new level, of course, and they won it in 2009. And I think it was incredibly vindicating for Kobe and empowering that he could take a team on his back and win a championship. And then, of course, they get there in 2010, and I had spent the whole year with the team, and he was just on a mission. I mean, there was just no chance that the Celtics were going to beat him again. And he took that on very personally. And he very openly said that that championship was the sweetest of the five that he had won because of everything involved with it. And he cited Jerry West, you know, losing to the Celtics six times and all the Lakers Celtic history and all that stuff. But there were a lot of demons at play there, and you know he was able to overcome and to bring it home. An incredible accomplishment, amazing accomplishment.
I always thought that to me one of the I called it what did I call it the knucklehead quotient, and I always say that if your player, if your team, your best player and your coach can get what players, what would be known as former knuckleheads of the NBA ring, it means something. I think of like Isaiah Ryder got a ring with the Lakers. Ron Artest now met a world peace, got a ring with the Lakers. JaVale McGee, I think, got a ring with the Warriors. It showed me the greatness of Steph Curry. He got JaVale McGee a ring. Rodman, a former knucklehead before he joined the Bulls and now a Hall of Famer. But I look at like you're a franchise a franchise's uncanny ability to take the biggest pain in the ass the NBA has ever known and transform that person into a winner, I think is like genius. And Phil did it, and Kobe did it numerous times with numerous players.
Well, Phil was the master at you know, mental. I don't want to call them mental games, but being able to get the guys to buy in, first of all, to the system, to the triangle. And then, you know, to mentally prepare them. And he was very radical in his methods, going back to the Bulls days, you know, with meditation and saging the locker room and all the Zen stuff, which people say is a lot of mumbo jumbo, but I don't think it was because it worked.
Completely. I think you're right. And I think that people forget Phil had a lot of old school in him too. And the one that like people talk about, Jeff Van Gundy used to make fun of him and but the bottom line is the guy was it's like John Wooden. John Wooden's whole thought was I need to find a way to get these guys to give themselves to the good of the group. And that's exactly what Phil Jackson's philosophy was. He went about it differently, but it worked. And any person that's a CEO of a company, if you can get people that are very good at what they do to give themselves to the good of the group and think beyond, you've got success. And I look at the guys, so just the people who took pictures with you, remember Jen Podhizer, Nat Steve, like all these. Nat Butler. I'm thinking Cat Stevens. Don't tell Nat Butler that. But all the, like you had some, you worked with a great team of people. It wasn't just you.
Oh yeah, we still going strong. I'm knocking on wood here, but so many of my colleagues are still out there. You know, Nat, of course, 35 plus years. Got Scott Cunningham in Atlanta, I think is over 40 now. 40
wow.
Years. You know, so many incredible photographers. There are three former assistants of mine that are now longtime tenured team photographers in the league. So,
Who are they?
What's that?
Who are they?
We got Garrett Elwood in Denver. You got Barry Gossage in Phoenix, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to count Nat in any way as an assistant, but Nat, you know, senior NBA photographer like me for so many years, but started literally as an assistant to me the first year or two back in 85, 86. So we're a very close-knit group. There aren't a lot of job opportunities. You know, there's only 28 jobs for the 30 teams because yeah. I cover both, you know, he covers the two New York area teams. I cover the two LA teams and there's not a lot of turnover, but the young people, the young photographers that have come into the league are very impressive. And it's great to have fresh blood and new ideas and people who actually understand the digital technology that the old dinosaurs like us don't.
Yeah.
So we're a good group led by Joe Amati at NBA Photos. And, you know, it's been interesting covering the league the way we've had to during the pandemic, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, we're off the court. We're not under the basket where we used to be, but we've adapted. And I think things will come back when they're ready to come back the way they used to be.
I'm gonna end this the way I get the best for last, in my opinion, because when I looked at your guest list over the last 3 years and Bruce sent the guys to me, I'm like, wait a minute. These are some of the same people, Bill Walton, Isaiah Thomas, Grant Hill, Bruce Bowen, Mike Breen, and David Stern. That one jumped out at me because as people know, David's final on camera sit down was with us and it was around Halloween 2019. And you know, I was fortunate enough that because basically his relationship with the great Bruce Bernstein, no relation to you, by the way, but who knows? As we talked about before this began, we're all a member of the tribe.
He has usurped my name.
He's
with David Stern.
I can see that. I could see Bruce doing that. and at any rate, you know, he gives us over an hour in his office. It's a remarkable conversation, not just because he was funny, playful, and it was almost like his final press conference where I could ask something and he would almost, you know, why shut up? And it was, you know, it was David at his best. And yeah. It revealed the side of his personality that I wish came out more when he was the commissioner, which was really endearing. Mm-hmm. And that he was, you know, maybe he was abusive, but he was also, he was the most caring ball buster I ever met. Like he said things for a reason. And if he didn't say anything, it was the classic, he didn't care about you. So, and we, you know, my favorite line, I literally go at one point, I'm sitting there and I go, you know, I hate to say this, but there are times when people said you were an asshole. And David looks at me and he goes, puts his finger, both his fingers on his chest like this. And he goes, moi? I mean, you couldn't make it up. Like me? No, never. And he just was so, I don't know. He's so maybe self-aware, thoughtful, more. He had a real self-reflection that I didn't see coming. Mm-hmm. Had him on your podcast. Do you remember that? Did he surprise you with any of his revelations in February of 2019 when you had him on?
Well, first of all, he was so incredibly gracious to allow me to come to his office and tape, you know, podcast there. And
so you got the same office we did.
Yeah, same office. Ugh. And he's got, you know, photos of mine on the wall that I took that I had sent to him or he had printed. So, you know, we're talking about that. He was incredibly relaxed. You know, I go back to the days with David that the core, you know, the nucleus of what the NBA was at the time. You know, we called him Uncle David. He wasn't Uncle David by the time he retired because, you know, it'd become this gigantic corporation, but he was still approachable. And he always had a good word. I obviously had to be on my toes every time I was with him and be incredibly professional. And he respected that. Yeah. And, when I got the Naismith Award, the Kurt Gowdy Award at the Hall of Fame, I go up on the stage to accept the award, and who is sitting front and center staring, like literally staring right up at me. He's like, okay, kid, what do you got? And
that's great. It
was intimidating, Mike. But then I turned it around in my head and I became very grateful to David and everyone else I saw out there in the audience for, everything that happened in my career was really due to all those people. And
that's intimidating though.
No, it was. It was. But I embraced the moment, and hopefully I rose to it. I don't know. But when I did the podcast, he was great. I mean, we got into all kinds of stuff, all kinds of questions, like about opening up China and what that meant, and what he was thinking in the moment. Then he told some stories I hadn't even heard about or knew about. The Communist Party in Russia and how they controlled basketball, and all the deals, any sponsorship deal had to like basically go through the Communist Party,
did he talk about that moment with me and probably with you where he sort of, when do you realize that this can become a global game? And I think it was with some of these former, KGB guys that are now head of whatever little basketball organization it was at the time, Russia. And they're like, you think Sabonis can play in the NBA? You think he can play? And he's like, what? These guys want Sabonis? Like, that's not a defection anymore. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like that. There was that moment that you just there, like you could see. And he said, I knew it right then. I knew it. They wanted this.
Yeah.
And so, so I thought that, that he just, he was such a, clairvoyant. He was so prescient about things. Bruce Bernstein, please join us for a minute because I know you know David real well. And anything you could add, an Uncle David story would be great.
At the end of 2017, when I was granted my free agency by ESPN, I called David's office and I spoke to Linda Tosse, his assistant. And I said, Linda, I'd really like to, talk to David if I could, whatever. So she puts him on the phone. And I said, David, I told him what happened with ESPN. I said, I could really use some big brotherly advice. And I think you're just the person to give it to me. Is there any chance that I could take a ride down to New York City and, just talk to you for a few minutes? And he's there. Yeah. He's there, work it out with Linda. And, so I did. And I came down on the train and I figured, all right, I'm going to spend, if I get 30 minutes with David, I'll be really happy. Well, it was about an hour and 15 minutes. And I used to work with him on the NBA draft. I was in charge of pushing him out, pulling him back in, blocking him from going out when he thought the show was going too slow, because he always wanted to go boom, boom, boom. And he used to give me a really hard time. He was, because as Andy said, David could be a very demanding boss and you kind of had to really be on your toes. So he sits on the sofa and he's talking to me. He looks at me, he's here. I was pretty tough on you sometimes.
Well,
I said, yeah, you were. He's there. Do you know why I did that? And I said, well, because you could. He's there. Well, yeah, but I was just trying to toughen you up. I'm like, thanks. But he was a wonderful, wonderful man. He really did become a friend because after 11 years of, and I used to joke, Tom Corelli, you guys both know Tom Corelli, and Tom and I used to be together during the draft. I said, TC, I'm the only guy in this building that can tell David Stern what to do, and he's got to have to listen to me, which wasn't really true. but it kind of was, because if I said, look, they're in a commercial break, you can't go out there. He kind of understood that, but he was a wonderful man. And I truly loved him. He was a great friend at the end and I miss him so much.
Oh God. Yes. What a loss. And he died the same month Kobe did. Last January 1st, Kobe died 26 days later. And it was the start of a horrendously terrible year for all of
us. Both shocks, by the way, even though David Stern was, what was he, 70s?
He's been in the hospital for 2 weeks or so.
But I mean, when we went to see him, he was all worried about his wife.
Yeah.
And yep. Because she just
heart issues. Yes.
Yeah. Right. And she just gone through and if you had told me that he was going to have a stroke and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he was going to, that it would just, I mean, when he went into the hospital and didn't come out, it was shocker on many levels. He just was one of those guys. I remember asking him during the thing, like, well, don't you just want to like take off some time? And he goes, why? I like working. He wanted to be doing something. He really wanted to.
Well, I want to get a plug in also and piggyback on what Bruce said, but get a plug in for some of the people that David surrounded himself with. Mm. As you mentioned Tom Corelli. I mean, people like Ski Austin, you know, Bal Ackerman, Rick Welts, you know, Russ Granick. I mean, you know, Terry Lyons and Brian McIntyre, our dear friends. I mean, these were people at the top of their profession that David, you know, had running this organization, and he knew how to recognize talent, and he knew how to push them and push the buttons that he needed to. And Rick Welts and I have talked about that many times. And, you know, it was a talent that very rare, I think, in management, that, you know, he wasn't really leading by intimidation, but he was leading by this shared vision that he got everybody to buy in on, magical time.
No, it really was. Yeah. And there are grumblings that he was sort of over the top and he'd F-bomb you to death and all that. There are millions of coaches out there that'll tell you, coach hates me. He sucks.
Yeah.
There are a lot more who say, coach got me to do the things I needed to be the best I am. And David Stern was the ultimate hard love teacher. Mm-hmm. That you go back to high school and you go, you know what? You kicked my ass, but I needed to have my ass kicked. And you did it because you knew that you knew how I would respond to it. And shoot, I even the times we had rows over things I wrote, just the way he dealt with me, it was, it was really a special time. Man, this has been good stuff. You know, I didn't even get into, I do a whole new podcast on you growing up in Brooklyn and
anytime
and going into Midwood High School. And just like your dad, I want to say one of your inspirations was your father coming up, but I imagine there was, if you could leave our listeners with, or and our viewers with one thing, like a fork in the road moment for you where you weren't sure what you were going to do in life, what you're going to be. And all of a sudden it went the way you needed it to go, or you made a decision. I love those stories. So if anything comes to your mind, and I think, and while people are watching this, are probably watching a catalog of your photos run too.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there's a couple, but one specifically was, I was going to the University of Massachusetts. I really loved photography. I was doing photography for our daily newspaper. But I wasn't really learning the craft of photography, all the artistic stuff I needed to learn, technical stuff. I was really learning on the fly. There were no classes at UMass that taught me that. And I had to make a really difficult decision. I mean, I was enjoying UMass, had a great set of friends. It was close to home. But I decided that if this was going to be my career, and I remember I was 18 years old, just about to turn 19, that I have to ratchet it up. I have to find a school that can really teach me this stuff and get me prepared for a career. And I decided to transfer to Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, which was like, you know, the other side of the world for me, and did it. And, you know, thank God I did. And I did it then because it was the right time, opened up some doors for me. I had teachers that believed in me, even though I was told many times at Art Center that this is not what we teach here. You're not going to get a career out of this. But, you know, Brooklyn guy doesn't give up. And you tell me I can't do something, of course, you know, what does that mean? I'm going to go do it even more. So that was a pivotal moment. The second one, Mike, I just got to say one more thing, is that my goal had always been, once I became a photographer, to get the cover of Sports Illustrated. Because if I got that cover, it means that I have entered into that elite group, you know, that they can't ever take that cover away from me. And when that happened in 85 at the Lakers championship, I felt like, wow, this was all worth it up until now. And I can
wait. Is that that's not the baby Skyhook? That's 87. No,
this was a really bizarre picture of Kareem, quite frankly, against the Celtics, where Danny Ainge is like reaching in, and I had the most bizarre position on the court. They put me on the sideline, like sort of free throw line extended on the sideline. No, but they don't do that anymore, obviously.
Yeah,
I got this just moment of Kareem like making a move. You can see Casey Jones and the Celtic bench behind, of course, all the Celtic fans. Kind of an innocuous moment, quite frankly, but they liked it. And I got the call that as we were going to the White House that next day, I got the call that I got the cover. And that really kind of validated everything up until that point for me.
That is amazing. In fact, Bruce, I wish you could put this up on the screen right now because I just called it up. Can you imagine? Is there any way I can put this up on the screen, that cover? No, I guess we could do it while we're
talking. I'm wondering if I have it hanging here somewhere.
I could put it in the chat. It doesn't matter though, I guess, if I put it in the chat.
This is my only prop that I have. I only got one prop here. So.
Well, that's funny.
This is it.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
Right.
You get that call and you must just be, wow. Oh,
it was crazy. I get a page. We're at the airport in Boston. The team had partied all night, right? We're getting on a plane. Nobody had slept, getting on a commercial plane to fly to Washington, which is never done, has never been done again, I guess.
Yeah.
On the way back to LA, we're going to stop in Washington, have a ceremony at the White House with President Reagan. Right. So I'm in, at the gate waiting. I get a page on my pager. I recognize it as an SI number. I call it. It's Eileen Miller, who's the photo editor. And she says, oh, well, I just want to let you know that you have the cover this week. And, they had two staffers there and they took my film as maybe a courtesy. I don't know. And so I was like so excited. This is the God's honest truth. I was so excited. And I look over, I see Kareem is sitting like in a chair, reading a book. I don't know who to say. I go over to him and said, Cap, unbelievable news. I got my first cover of SI and it's a picture of you. And he goes, that's great, kid. The guys had like 35 covers at that point.
Yeah, right. He was on the cover when he was at Power Memorial, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's hilarious. That's my New York Times. When the New York Times hired me, that was like the same moment. Like, oh my God, wait, I'm validated in life. Forget about professional. I'm validated in life now. Yeah. It's so cool, man.
Yeah, you
that's
can awesome. Relate. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think so. Like you said, the great thing about these stories and the podcast is, everybody thinks that you automatically got into this club by just showing up one day. And really, there are all these weird forks in the road and these things that had to happen. Like just the idea that Eileen Miller and the staff are looking at photos going, you know what? I like Andy Mercy's here. Like, this is really good. Like, boom, that's a major moment.
Oh,
you know? And so like,
unbelievable moment. I these moments are like ingrained in my memory that I'll never forget them.
Yeah. Well, that's as I said, like as much as all these guys always talk about winning titles and how it validates them. Whether it's Willis Reed, Shaq, wherever, you talk to them years later, and it's like it's about the relationships.
Yeah.
It's about this. It's about the journey. It's not about the destination. It was about the journey we went through. Mm-hmm. And in media fashion, that's our story in many ways. And so, anyway, you spent overtime with us. It's been awesome. And I'm glad that we can put up the pictures too. I think that's going to even make it that much stronger.
Well, thanks so much, guys, to both of you. I really appreciate it. So much fun. Mike, I miss seeing you. I miss seeing all my journalists.
Oh, thanks, man.
But at some point, we'll be down in the media again, I'm sure.
Yeah, there'll be a moment, whether it's, if not this year, next year, where we kind of end up in a hospitality room at a hotel going, holy shit, what was that?
That was dope.
Thanks to my guest, Hall of Fame photographer and podcast host, Andy Bernstein. That's Legends of Sport, kiddies. Get it. Also, thanks to my producer, Bruce Bernstein. No relation. Bruce, it's your big moment. Hit us with the promos, my friend.
Thanks, Mike. Andy was amazing. And yes, we need to thank our wonderful editor, Kristen Woolley. As you mentioned at the beginning of the show, this show is available on our Pure Hoops Media YouTube channel. And Kristen is going to do a great job really mixing in Andy's photos with the presentation. It's going to be beautiful. So please check out all of our Pure Hoops Media shows. We have Full Court with Fisher and Kay every Tuesday, Best in College Hoop. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto Strong and Aaron Berlin is here every Wednesday. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Monica McNutt and King McClure each Thursday. And the Pure Hoops Podcast with BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman every Friday. And of course, you, my man Mike, with a new Mike Wise show every Monday. Also, we just released part two of our two-part series with George Raveling and Wayne Embry on Dave's Front Office. The Hall of Famers joined Dave Wohl and shared stories of their battles against discrimination and overcoming prejudice to reach the top of the basketball world.
In part two, George tells the story about working security for Dr. Martin Luther King during his I Have a Dream speech in 1963 and how the speech got its name after the fact. And please check out our YouTube channel with dozens of great segments, including my very unplugged conversation with Lakers Governor Jeannie Buss. Go to YouTube and search for Pure Hoops Media. Bruce, I think I'll finish it out with this. Hopefully the year 2021 is when we snuff out this pandemic. Get your vaccinations when you qualify for it. I don't care what you've heard, what you think. Just get on the list, get your shot in your arm. Let's protect each other. Wear the mask in public to protect yourselves and others. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and be considerate of others. And keep all the medical professionals in your prayers. Till next time, aloha.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.